the world. I do think, however, that there is in the world today, certainly, no group in which ritualism has become so highly complicated as in Roman Christianity. In most other countries, ritualism has retained a certain simplicity. Now, one answer to this may be that most other countries have not had the wealth or the physical means to sustain so tremendous a program. Also, in most other countries, religions have not been so completely dominant as they are here. They have nearly always had certain divisions within their own structure. For example, taking China, where three religions share a certain degree of equality. Therefore, there is no complete dominance of one, or one that has able to control the economic resources of the entire country. While there have been some state religions, most of these state religions have not been like the Western ones. And here we have something that perhaps is worth another passing moment of thought. And that is, what is the essential reason why Western ritualism has become so complicated and Eastern has not? Most of the Eastern nations have had similar emergencies as those that influenced the West. Perhaps the answer is very definitely in the psychology of the people. The East in general, and the whole Eastern Hemisphere, is strangely introverted. The East has always thought of religion primarily as something internal. The religious growth in Asia has always been a growth inward, from the circumference of the personality to some root within it. Whereas in the West, whether the Greek or Roman, Egyptian or Assyrian empires are involved, always progress, growth has been an externalizing. The West has always brought things out of itself into its environment and has created great forms. Even as Cain became the builder of cities, so it seems as though Western man has always been building exterior to himself. He has surrounded himself with greatness, whereas Eastern man has mysteriously always thought of the virtue, the dignity, the serenity, the sublimity of simplicity. He has had a little different attitude, and I think we can observe it in the fact that Eastern religions have, for the most part, with the possible exception of Islam, never had the political ambitions that have dominated Western religious groups. So as a result of that, in your Asiatic religion, you find ritual. But because this ritual has never been completely involved in a vast pageantry, which has extended it from a comparatively simple thing into so involved a process that a complete study of the mass and mastery of its technique will require 10 years of work. The other peoples of the world haven't done this. And so perhaps in some of these other simpler groups, you can find that which is almost totally submerged in the mass. You can find perhaps the essential principle of the symbolism, separated from its extremely numerous and glittering encrustations that have assembled and gathered around it over the period of centuries. In all religious ritual, whether it be East or West, what is the essential purpose for a sacrament or for a rite such as the Mass? We speak of Buddhist Masses. They are also given. We also know that certain elements of the Mass, not complete, but fragments of it, particularly the Eucharist, have survived in the Protestant denominations. So that even in Christianity, certain elements of ritual are for the most part perpetuated in a very modified form by a number of Protestant groups. The essential purpose of the religious ritual in most of the Eastern nations has been an extension of the concept of individual prayer. In other words, ritual is a gathering of a people for the purpose of glorifying God. It is a collective, congregational kind of worship. Now, in most places, although not in all, worship is divided into two distinct sections. One is a worship by means of a hierarchy of priests, and the other is private worship. Therefore, in the Orient also, you find the same situation prevails. In most Hindu, Buddhist, Shinto temples, priests are available. Priests perform certain rites and certain rituals and have certain daily observances that are peculiar to their own obligations through ordination. In other words, a priest or a monk of almost any of these religious groups is required by his obligations to perform certain pious ceremonies which are not required of a layman. Thus, there is more activity in a religious house among its priests than there are among the laity. A second point in connection with this is that on certain days, there are public ceremonies performed essentially by the clergy, but witnessed by the non-clergy. These public ceremonies consist of celebrations relating to sacred days associated with the life of the founder of the religion, or to certain universal astronomical or cosmological dates which have gradually been involved in the theology. This common practice is in both East and West. The various rituals and ceremonies differ slightly with the different sects, for these rites and ceremonies were inaugurated by the founders of sects rather than by the founder of the religion itself. In Buddhism in Japan, we have 12 or 15 sects of importance, each of which has minor differences of ritual. All are essentially dedicated to the same principles, but each has distinguished a way of worship that varies slightly from others. And in this way, these ways of worship have particular meaning to members of that group and are less meaningful to non-members. In the development of the Mass in Christendom, at least 9 different patterns developed. These patterns, however, have gradually divided themselves into the Roman and non-Roman Catholic churches, and the non-Roman, including the Greek and a number of other Near Eastern groups. Some also the Copts in North Africa. But these different rituals are performed primarily in honor of or in testimony of gratitude to, or in beseechment of, the power of the divine being represented. Now, how would you say, for example, that the Buddhistic, which might be a parallel to Christianity in many respects, how would the problem of the Mass, for the Buddhists have a Mass, relate, for instance, to the common symbolism that we know in the Christian Church? In the Buddhist temples, there may or may not be images of the Buddha, Bodhisattvas, Arhats, saints, and sages. If they are there, they are enshrined or altered very much as in the case of the Western Church. There may be smaller rooms, chapels to various deities, such as Kuan Yin or Seishi or one of the other Bodhisattvas, and there may be a great central icon or image or painting either of a single divinity or of a triad. persons coming in to the presence of this image or group of images usually make some genuflection as a symbol of humility or as greeting. In most Buddhist countries, the greeting used is exactly the same as used for another human being. There is not too much essential difference. There are not elaborate rituals relating to the recognition of a deity in a church or temple and the recognition of a friend by salutation. The presence of the image is intended for only one purpose, and I think this is true essentially in Christianity also. It is merely a symbol of a principle. It is a central symbol sanctifying that place, indicating that it is a sanctuary, that it is not a house of business or of entertainment, but that it is a place of worship. And in the presence of the image, which is usually in a central or altar position, the individual is acknowledging not the image, but the concept, principle, or energy for which that image stands. This recognition may consist either of prayer, or of meditation, or of intercession, the pleading that the deity will be of help in some emergency. It may be merely a ceremonial occasion, as with certain festivals, in which the gathering is merely to honor the deity, or it may be a supplication for help in some great emergency or difficulty. Even, however, where it appears that the image is the central element in the design, I think it is the same as in the Christian church, that the image, the crucifix, or whatever may be present, is merely the emblem of a conviction, and that this emblem of conviction is used as a means of focusing or centralizing the attention of the individual. Now, if you go into one of the old literary works dealing with these problems in the Orient, you come upon a very interesting thing. Long ago in Japan, the great Fujiwara princess lived in a very wonderful world. It must have been a world of great art, great beauty, and great serenity. The natural love of beauty of these older people and the peculiarly sensitive appreciation they had for law and order made their world a very charming one. At that time, the Fujiwara princes were converts to the doctrine of the Amida, or the doctrine of the intercession of the Amida Buddha for the redemption of mankind. This perhaps is that phase of Buddhism nearest to Christianity in its essential meaning. So in this period, what did the Fujiwara princes do? They really believed that it would be possible to prepare a world here so beautiful and so wonderful that actually they could fashion Amida's Western Paradise right in the wonderful isles of the island of Japan. So they built magnificent temples based upon the ancient paintings and pictures and upon the stories of the old sutras of Buddhism. They filled these temples with marvelous statuary. They trained priests and temple dancers, musicians, so that these temples became, in their glory, something utterly beyond description. It was really as though they had floated down from the skies. And in this very wonderful, if somewhat decadent atmosphere, these people actually attempted to create a world as beautiful, as filled with peace, as gentle, and as forever thoughtful as the mysterious world of Amida that was supposed to be far beyond the Western Sea of Life. Now, in this, I think perhaps we have the secret of a good many things. These Fujiwara princes, in creating their rituals based upon the sacred text of the Mahayana Sutras, developed a wonderful, unworldly pattern, the purpose of which was to lift the human consciousness out of the everyday and give that consciousness an immediate, if only transitory, experience of eternity. In other words, this whole pattern was to cause a tremendous psychological experience within the individual. But in the course of their great ritual, these Fujiwara princes, therefore, filled their wonderful palaces with lights and flambeaux, filled them with song and beauty, filled the gardens with flowers and birds, and created this wonderful kind of world in the midst of which were the processions of yellow-robed priests chanting the ancient hymns of the law. They really felt as though in those rituals they were picked up out of this world and taken into another kind of a realm. And in this other realm, they've also experienced a great consolation of spirit. They sensed that heaven was near. They were aware eternally of the presence of beauty, that it was only a short distance from this world to the other, and that this world also could shine with the radiance of that larger universe. Thus, in a sense, all of the temples represented miniatures of a larger and better world. Each sanctuary was its own little vaulted heaven. Each one of these sacred places was a place into which man retired out of worldliness, into the beauty and sublimity of his faith. And the rituals and rites, therefore, seem to carry the individual into this great world over which the gilded Amitabha ruled forever among the radiant flowers and jewel lakes of his celestial palace. The idea was, therefore, that in a mysterious way, even here, while you still live, you can experience something of the world of God that lies beyond the visible. I think this instinct was present in all ancient religious beliefs. This instinct to try to create somewhere in the world something that had to do with the other world. Something that was not just a palace for a king, but to a measure at least was a doorway to a world of greater mystical value. It was only this mysterious contact or sense of contact with infinity that probably could hold barbarians in check and could bring Darius to his knees. There was something that was unworldly about it all. And I think that in a sense, as we study the Mass or study some great mystical interpretation of the Mass, such as we find in Wagner's Parsifal, there seems to be no doubt in the world that in the celebration of Mass in a great cathedral, the experience of hierarchy is very strongly intended. In other words, the individual is lifted up by a mystical experience into some kind of a sense of a spiritual world. The great cathedral with its wonderful windows and its vaulted arches is just not of this world. And although it may be a monument of centuries of human labor, when lighted only with flickering candles, and here surrounded by all the habiliments of a great faith, the solemnity of the Mass is exhibited. It is something that becomes a kind of immediate mystical visual experience. It is the building up of faith through the eyes. It is the strengthening of some kind of an inner belief through exhibiting to that belief the pomp and circumstance of a great pageantry. After all, to the medieval Christian, God was king. God was not to what the mystic thinks of God. God was really a great spiritual monarch, ruling over a sublime and supreme court in heaven, more glorious than the courts of any kings of earth. God was an absolute despot. God was served by a mysterious hierarchy of angels and archangels and cherubim, and on earth by a strange hierarchy of dedicated persons, and his vice-regent upon earth was the Pope of Rome. Thus, a great sense of medieval imperialism was sensed. But this was the way of the life of that time. This and this alone could bring these people to their knees. This alone could cause that peculiar psychological experience by which man forgets to ask reasonable questions and becomes completely overwhelmed by the mysterious testimony of his own senses. Great music, great art, the strange rhythms of the mass, the weird cries of the Kyrie, all of these things are out of man's common experience. They represent something that psychologically touches his inner construction, and by this inward touching brings him into some kind of immediate experience of the importance of the religious equation in life. Now, this importance may be falsely evaluated. This importance may be steeped in numerous superstitious doctrines, but this importance still becomes a guide to a way of life. And for millions of persons, this importance, this guide to a way of life, has led to a certain adjustment with existence that has resulted in a life of faith that was very strong, a life of sincerity that was very deep, and a life far away from the conspiracies by which the very situation itself was engendered. So out of this whole problem, there certainly seems to come to our attention that these factors help to set some kind of a belief in the souls of men. When you take all art and all music, all beauty and all solemnity away from a religion, I don't think you can deny the fact that you impoverish this religion in some way. You ask of man something that normally he cannot give. Namely, you ask him to carry completely himself the full burden of his religious life. You try to tell him that religion is tremendously important, but that he must discover this only through some experience within his own consciousness. You throw everything upon the individual. Now, actually and ultimately, this probably is the proper end of things, that the individual must carry this. He must work out his own salvation. He must achieve virtue through his own inner integrity. But it is very, very difficult to make this work in common practice. It is like saying to a person on another level entirely, there is no need for you to go to school. If you will study 8 hours a day from the time you're 7 till the time you're 25 at home by yourself, you can learn just as much, and there are schools that will credit you for this work. But who's going to do it? Who is going to self-discipline himself sufficiently to devote this time to make this effort for the sake of becoming educated? It's almost impossible to expect this to be done by the average human being. Only in company with others of similar effort, only when he moves with his age group, only when he shares in certain minor competitive instincts with his classmates, can you keep him in line with a long-range educational program. He will not do it by himself. It is the same way with religion. It is very hard for the individual to achieve a spiritual state without some form of religious symbolism to support him. This can be excessive and unnecessary, but that some part of it is present seems to be a natural necessity for man. He needs the periodic experience of sincerity. He needs the strength of some form of religious symbolism. He needs it through art or through music or through something. He needs some religious study to integrate his efforts. And unless there is some pattern by which he can develop his spiritual resources, he is not inclined to do so. Therefore, I do believe, after watching the whole situation pretty carefully for a great many years, that there is some need in modern religion for a greater expression of emotional warmth, a greater release of the instinct to beauty, rather than a sort of square-toed Puritanism which has gradually come to dominate our concept of religious life. Our religious life in the West has, for the most part, with the exception of the various Catholic churches, has lost most of its emotional warmth. It's lost its art. It's lost its music. It's lost its magnificence in the sense most necessary to the experience of man. I'm not talking of hierarchy. I'm talking of the simple impact of religious value upon the consciousness of the person. Now, it is perfectly true that the individual can go out into nature and come into the most beautiful cathedral that was ever created if he has the insight. And the mystic has the insight. The mystic does not need ritualism. But how many actual mystics do we have? How many people find their religious life strong enough by their own mystical convictions alone to enable them to live the principles that they believe? I think only in modern time we are having a difficulty. This was one of the difficulties that the church faced nearly 1,800 years ago. We are concerned gravely today with, for example, the lack of religion among young people. This doesn't apply to all young people, but there is an increasing number who apparently are falling away from religious conviction, and this increasing number is also falling into various types of juvenile delinquency at an alarming rate. I do not believe that we would have half of our burglaries and 60% of our auto theft in the United States committed by juniors if these young people had any deep reverence for value, had any deep appreciation of something more important than doing exactly as they jolly well please. I don't believe that if these people, these young people, had grown up with a vision of the nobility of religion in their souls, that they could so quickly have forgotten it. Nor do I think that the majority of these young people are in a condition to accurately form their own religion. I don't think they can go unaided into the maze of modern theologies and find what they need. I think they must recognize some pattern, some value structure by which they are given a situation which gives their respect, in which they come to respect and honor value. Now, the great value of life is that which is honored in quietude, recognized in meditation, experienced in devotion. It is something that, like the old palaces of the Fujiwara emperors, it is something built in this world to stand to the glory of the eternal. Now, I don't think that this needs to be a sacerdotal structure as it was before the building of the pyramid. I don't think it needs to be sectarian or creedal. But I do believe there should be something in our lives to remind us that we live in a universe of truth, a universe of principles, and that the greatest joy, the greatest good in this whole world comes to those who are able to truly love that which is truly worthwhile. And we've lost it. We've lost it almost completely. In our rebellion against indulgences and perversions, we have lost also this something by means of which we come to an inward symbolic experience of the divine world around us and in us. We don't have to be creedal and sectarian about any part of this, because actually this universal temple, which is the divine nature of things, is available to us through our own hearts. It is available to us through our own quietudes and through our own meditation. But I do think that it is rather good that something in the form of an adequate sanctuary to rise in the midst of nations, not something to our creeds and to the battle of our sects, but something that stands forever for the principle of good, a value unchanging in a changing world, that somewhere we should have that tie with heaven, that binding to the sky, by means of which we are not lost forever in the shadow and gloom of our own mistakes. I think this was what ancient peoples tried to do. I think it was that they believed that if you had periodic contact with that which is sublime, that you would be a better person. But you might not understand everything, but perhaps even out of this not understanding, you gain the strength that even understanding cannot bestow. What was needed, what was wanted, was that man should realize that he lived in a world that was bigger than business, bigger than the physical things that he was concerned with, bigger than the ambitions of princes, bigger than the tyrannies of the time. A world which also guided him in his values. A world in which he was prepared to meet the changes of life, prepared to come and prepared to go, that he had to live with faith and die with faith. Somewhere along the line, we lost this. And I think this has been the greatest cross that Christendom has ever had to bear, is that it gradually lost so much of its faith and found in its place only too much fear. Fear has been the most destructive element in the entire development of Christianity. This fear, which tried to make men good, only finally turned them from the faith. This idea that somewhere, some way, some terrible destiny awaited us unless we were good Orthodox members or something, actually ruined our faith. It took it apart. It destroyed its value for us. Because in this very experience of fear, we lost our primary love and respect for truth. How could we truly love and truly fear our God at the same time? Instead of being the devout father, the wonderful parent, God gradually became the difficult and distinct stepfather, the tyrant. And out of this fear, which undoubtedly was a machinery of preservation at an old time, came gradually the law of most of our religious convictions. We have probably turned from religion more due to fear than to any other single cause. I don't mean necessarily that we were all afraid, but I mean that the idea of fear in a faith destroyed our own faith in that faith. that the human heart, in its own natural instinct, does not naturally fear. The human heart does not fear to live nor fear to die. It has to be educated into fear. Its own natural instinct is faith. It does not want to be lifted up into a sublime experience one moment and cast downward into the concept of purgatory the next. So by degrees, this inconsistency aroused the bitterness of science, aroused the animosity of the intellectual, gradually brought criticism after criticism upon the whole structure of theology, until finally, to escape the fear, we gave up the faith. This is more or less the story of modern man, who is now struggling desperately to regain his sense of orientation. In your Mass, in your great experience of the Mass, you certainly do sense the splendors of a divine court. You sense some power or some authority beyond our own. You partake of a ritual that goes back thousands of years. You are moved atavistically by the most primitive and ancient instincts within yourself. But when you come out of this into fear, something of precious value is utterly destroyed. So some way we have to get a universe in which we can have this heaven without the corresponding hell. And we are told that in all the mental and moral polarities of life, you cannot have one without the other. You cannot have a concept of eternal good without some vision of eternal ill. This, I believe, is a false belief, but we still have it. The answer lies in the direct inward realization of reality itself. For if, instead of clinging to beliefs by which men divide each other, and all religions have to some measure this problem, we come rather into the sense of reality. If out of the sublimity of religious experience we arise finally to the realization that there is an eternal fact, and that for this fact there is no shadowed error, that in the universe itself, being is not polarized. There is not light and darkness in the state of the human soul. There is reality. And men have termed it light and darkness. So that out of all of this, we have the possibility of discovering a universe of infinite justice, infinite truth, infinite wisdom, and infinite love. And at the same time, there is nothing in this universe to fear. If we can gain more understanding of that, I think we will gain a great deal. Now, locked within the very essence and heart of the entire mystery of the Mass is the Eucharistic rite, in which the mystery of the transformation of the bread and the wine into the very living nature, body, substance, and essence of Christ. This mystery is said to be achieved. I think that underneath this entire mystery, we could find the answer if we also read a little further, perhaps, in the Gospel of Paul, the Gospels of Paul. Here we find his clear and distinct statement that the Christ in you, the hope of glory. Therefore, the transubstantiation of the host occurs in you. That this outer is a reminder, is a magical or mystical rite which perhaps could contribute a little something to the realization. Even as your mandala diagrams in Shingon Buddhism, by their own arrangements, create within you a certain receptivity to universal law and order. The transubstantiation, therefore, is, in fact and substance, as Paul tells us, is that instant of realization in which all things become new. This is the mystical experience of Potina. This is the moment in which man glimpses the infinite fact of things. And in this infinite fact, all things which are material, represented by the bread and the wine, become transformed. And we perceive that their materiality is only of an appearance, and that all things are substantially spiritual. And that this realization of the substantial spiritual universe in which we exist also opens to our psychic or inner life the great mystery of our true nutrition. For if it is true that man's body is supported by the bread of this world, so it is true also that his spirit is supported by the bread of righteousness. And as it is true that he may drink of the water of this world and thirst again, he may also drink of the water of eternal life and thirst no more. Thus there is this eternal nutrition, and there is a physical or formal nutrition. Aquinas tries to tell us that the body must have its bread, and it must have its nutrition. But that by the very chemistry of assimilation and digestion, the transubstantiation occurs in the very process of the digestion of food. A great mystery occurs in man when, in the service of life, the bread which he takes into his body is transformed into the life energy which must sustain him. Thus, the human body is continually performing a strange and mysterious Eucharistic rite. And from this alone, ancient people seem to have gained a wonderful sense of value or a sense of authority for their own beliefs. But if we can assume that in the absolute apex of the Eucharistic ritual, that the concept is that in that moment, man, through the inward enlightenment of his own nature, by an instant of extraordinary devotion, of extraordinary integrity, of complete sincerity, of total self-forgetfulness in the experience of the divine, that in that moment he is able to suddenly feel or know within himself the transformation of his own consciousness. In that moment, he attains the true mystery of the Eucharist. In that moment, all things that happen are again happening or occurring in the terms of a great messianic principle, as Paul calls it. For if Christ be lifted up in you, then all else that is necessary shall be accomplished. This lifting up of Christ in you is the elevation of the host. It is this exhilaration experience. And by Christ, we know that the early church represented or signified the universal love of God, the same principle of infinite salvation that is intrinsic in every grain of sand and every atom of space. Therefore, the spirit of the true Savior is the actual presence in man of the power of his own salvation. So if this can be brought into focus in a dynamic experience, although this experience may last only a few seconds, it constitutes the miracle of faith fulfilled. It constitutes the establishment of the experience of spiritual certainty. It accomplishes that moment of identification with that which is eternal and inevitable. So that in the midst of this mysterious ritual, there is supposed to be a strange and mystic separation of the sheep from the goats. And the ecclesia or the temple itself is the sheepfold. And it is here also that the ritual was performed, in which at a certain point the profane were ordered to depart. And only those who were purified and prepared. We are permitted to assemble for the final and greatest part of the sacrament. Then, when the profane had departed, the purpose of the final ritual was to create this mood, this created sense of the presence of God, with the conviction that if this mood was strengthened by whatever outward means were available, whether it was the simplest gathering of devout persons or the most magnificent clustering of the glories of a great mass, whatever it was, if it caused the individual to suddenly be united with his brethren and with his God, he in this one moment of experience achieved the two commandments of Jesus. For if he in this instant recognized that he and his fellow members of the congregation were united as one being in Christ, and at the same time, he, the priest, the bishop, the hierarchy, were also all united in one substance in God, that in this sense, immediate sense of identity, was perhaps as well expressed as any other the entire concept of the mystical experience. For the mystical experience in Christendom consists of these two factors, which have to be simultaneously and identically experienced, namely the infinite fatherhood of God and the eternal brotherhood of man. These must both take part in the experience itself. In Christendom, the experience is not an experience of wisdom alone, nor is it an experience totally of an apotheistic state of being lifted up into a kind of ecstasy of God. In the mystical experience in connection with the Christian Mass, the end is twofold and clearly indicated. First, that the individual shall feel himself to be one with the congregation, that the congregation is now one being, and that this congregation, now one being, is the church. It isn't the building with the towers and the bells and the walls. It isn't the long cloistered corridors with the stations of the cross. It isn't the altars and the side altars. It isn't the nave and the crypts below. The church, or the ecclesia, is the assembly of those who have experienced the identity of life, the complete and absolute sense of brotherhood in Christ. At the same time, experiencing that this brotherhood, all of it, exists within the vaster and greater fatherhood of deity. So to experience the immediacy of union with the Father, and at the same time to reach out to the immediate experience of absolute kinship with our brethren, these two constitute one experience. They are the same experience as mentioned in the by the Arhats of Buddhism or by the mystics of the Vedanta. It is two ways of expressing the one truth, and that is the final achievement of illumination by the experience of the unity of all existent life. And that this unity of existent life includes all creatures existing with us, or visible or unseen by us. Also, that it includes our relationship with that one eternal source of life, with which we are also bound in the same mystical relationship. This is also symbolically set forth in certain phases of the Mass. And these phases, of course, include the prayers for the dead. They include prayers to and for the saints, for the visible and the invisible, for those here and those hereafter, for those not born and those who have passed on, and for those souls in transition, waiting purification. The prayer signifies the union of consciousness with all orders of life, mundane and supramundane. Thus, in a strange way, the entire ceremony summarizes a kind of mystical experience. Whether those who fashioned it knew this, we do not know. But those who pass through it under certain conditions experience it, regardless as to whether it was intentionally placed there or merely represents the psychological culmination of man's spiritual quest over the ages. In any event, this is the way it adds up, and this is what it points to. And I think we must realize that this is the underlying structure of the ritual and symbolism of the Mass in Christianity. Well, our time is up, so I don't want to